we're talking about the Western Climate Initiative here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So when we talk about cap and trade programs, something which is very important is how high or low to set the cap. In other words, how much greenhouse gas may be emitted by all the greenhouse gas emitters in the West or wherever the region is you're talking about. And then how is that lowered over time? And are those decisions based on science or are they based purely on politics?
Well, you know, it's actually also based on what we think we can do, which is kind of a combination of both. You know, this program starts in 2012, and the cap in 2012 will be used or will be developed using our best estimates of what those emissions are going to be, and we're going to have to develop them in 2010 to give industry a heads up. Some states will have numerous emission reductions before then, some will have a lot of growth, so we'll include all of that when doing those estimates. And then there's kind of this straight line trajectory of 15% below 2005 levels by 2020, which will be the endpoint, and that's where we're headed.
And the science is telling us that by the middle of the century, we need to have a 75 or 80% reduction in emissions. And as you may have noticed, really for many years, even decades, the science has become more and more clear, and each time there's another scientific study that comes out, it shows that the situation is even worse than they thought.
Right.
And so we really need to get on this trajectory toward a significant reduction by the middle of the century. And we think that the WCI targets beginning of 15% cut by 2020 is a good start toward that. We need to get on that trajectory, but we need to continue beyond 2020 to have additional significant emission reductions.
It seems like if you were to look at the graph showing what is necessary by when, and then you were to look at the graph showing the speed at which people, especially politicians, change their mind and get on the program, they look really different.
They really do, and we don't have a lot of time to get a handle on this problem. And unfortunately, the emissions that have already been put into the atmosphere, even if, and of course this isn't going to happen, even if we were to somehow stop all our emissions tomorrow, still there would be residual effects of the greenhouse gas pollution that's already been put into the atmosphere. But what we hope we can do, what we are confident we can do, is to head off the really catastrophic effects of climate change if we're able to quickly begin to reduce our emissions and continue that through the decades.
I imagine that industry is very worried about the economic impacts on them. And of course, if it's a utility, they're going to pass those economic impacts straight on to us for turning on our lights. It'll cost twice or three times or 10 times as much or whatever. How are we as a society dealing with that?
Well, you know, it's an issue that's on the mind of a lot of people. You know, how do we address the economic impacts of this program? And it's on the mind of the WCI too. And so we designed this program very carefully to help contain costs to industries and the consumers. As David mentioned earlier, things like early emission reductions help do that. A robust offset program is really important to that. And then the free distribution of allowances, rather than selling every ton, but distributing some for free, will also help keep costs down, both to the consumer and to industry.
Wait, free distribution of allowances, meaning, here, you can emit a ton of carbon without paying for it.
That's right.
But how does that help the global warming situation?
Well, they're still under the cap. They still have to reduce. There still is a cost for purchasing some of those allowances. Let me back up just a little bit. There's a few ways you can distribute allowances to industry. One is to auction. One is to freely allocate. One is just pay a price rather than auctioning it. In the WCI design, we settled on a 10% minimum auction for the first part of the program.
10% minimum auction, what does that mean?
Of the total allowances that are out there. So for New Mexico, we have maybe 45 million metric tons. If we auction 10% of that, that's 4.5 million metric tons that would be auctioned. And the rest could be freely distributed or auctioned or sold or however. So a 10% is what the minimum will be.
So you have a group of utility people standing in a room with paddles and say, I'll pay $5.
Well, we're establishing the auction right now, or the auction design right now. And we're looking at the European auction, the Reggie auction, Australia's designed an auction. So we're looking at different ways to set up that auction. And the auction will probably start in 2011. So there's a good reason to have both free allocation and auction. The European market has been mostly free auction, and they're moving more towards free allocation. They're moving more towards auction now. You need it to set the price. You need it to help provide incentive. But you know, I believe that ramping up the auction amount is the right way to go, especially for industries that aren't used to paying for those emission allowances. If you're paying $20 a ton and you've got 10 million metric tons, you know, that's a lot of money to an industry. So I think it, bringing them into it gradually is a good thing. So
I'd like to underscore that point. In order to create a phase-in period and in order to keep the overall increases in energy costs at a reasonable level for consumers, that certainly in the early years, allocating allowances freely makes a lot more economic sense than a heavy-handed auction policy.
Sometimes when we look at situations wherein multinational U.S.-based oil companies make profits that are so staggeringly huge, and their profits are coming from individual citizens paying higher costs for that energy. I mean, that must factor into it as well. Is there a way to put a cap on... I mean, you can't really put a cap on their profits.
No, we can't put a cap on their profits. And I think some industries, I want to point out related to just that point, some industries are more conducive to receive free allocations than others. In New Mexico, we have a regulated utility environment where electricity is heavily regulated by the PRC. And so we feel more comfortable providing free allocations to utilities. And that's what is in the Global Warming Solutions Act that is over at the Capitol right now. But for other industries, it may not be necessary to give them free allocations. Now, there's this whole competitive issue, too, you know. So if you've got sources that are leaving the state because they don't want to be regulated because they're concerned about the cost, if we firmly believe that there is a competitive issue there, then those would also be sources where we might want to freely allocate. So there's a lot to look at when you freely allocate or auction and make those and determine who gets the free allocations and who has to purchase their allowances through auction.
Yeah, Sarah had mentioned quite a bit earlier the importance of the leakage problem. Free allowances mitigates that leakage problem significantly because it would mitigate important cost differences between like a refinery in Utah or New Mexico on the one hand and a refinery in some place like Nebraska or Iowa on the other. So allowing free allowances would dampen the price differences for consumers in the WCI states versus consumers in states that are outside the WCI jurisdictions.
Right, right. Now, we have this bill introduced by Congressman Rotifer in the House here in the New Mexico legislative session right now. I think it's Bill 653.
That's correct.
And what is at stake in terms of passing this bill during this legislative session?
Well, New Mexico is an important state in all of this, especially in the Western Climate Initiative. Even though we're not the biggest in terms of the population, we are the first oil and gas state to comprehensively address climate change, and that presents a unique set of challenges for us. So while it wouldn't be ideal if we didn't get the bill, ideally we would get the bill this year, we would be able to spend the next couple of years putting a responsible program in place that tracks the Western Climate Initiative. That would be ideal. If we don't get the bill through this year, it won't derail New Mexico's participation. We'll continue to participate and work with our partners in the Western Climate Initiative and to work with the Obama administration on program design at the regional and the national levels. And we'll try again with a bill next year if we don't get it this year.
And so if the Obama administration is successful in doing, for example, a national cap and trade program of the kind that the WCI is talking about, but really doing an aggressive and effective cap and trade program on a national level, what would happen to the regional programs?
We've built into our bill for New Mexico that our program would sunset, that it would go away if the federal government implemented a program of equal or greater stringency to what we're planning on doing, because we really do prefer a national program. But in the absence of that, as we've talked about, you know, the whole time, we can't delay. So that's how we've set it up in New Mexico to address that problem.
Do you have a sense of how legislators and how the public are responding to this issue?
I think there's a difference between those two. The public
is responding.
What?
You mean the public is not perfectly represented by its legislators?
Well, the public is very concerned about climate change. And, of course, in the recent financial crisis, public priorities have shifted some toward financial issues, but there's still overwhelming support for among the public for addressing climate change in a serious way. And polls specifically say they want their governments to do more to aggressively address climate change. And we did see through 8 years of the Bush administration at the federal level that there really just wasn't the motivation within the federal administration, and that's why these regional initiatives have popped up. Here in New Mexico, we're hopeful that the Global Warming Solutions Act will pass this year, but we do recognize that it's an uphill battle.
So when you talk about the public and the legislators not exactly lining up, what kind of objections are you seeing to climate change and environmental legislation in general within the legislature?
Well, this has been a tough year for environmental legislation in the New Mexico legislature, and there's been a lot of back.
Really?
It has. I mean, it's sort of surprising because some of the new faces in the legislature, you know, are great environmentalists and want to support us on some of these initiatives. But it has been a hard year. We've seen a lot of bills that oppose some of the regulations that we've adopted over the last 6 years. We're seeing just a backlash to some of that. And it's especially tough in a year when the economy is not doing very well. Unfortunately, a lot of times we see people turn to the environmental regulations as their number one cause of the problem, and that's not really fair, but that does happen.
I think the leakage issue highlights some of the legislative concern, Mary Charlotte, in as much as legislators are concerned about jobs being exported out of state as a result of climate and other regulations.
And just to reiterate, leakage means that if you have a regulatory environment in one area and not in another area, we even have that in Santa Fe City versus Santa Fe County, where people are worried that jobs will go into the county because we implement a minimum wage, and that turns out not to really have been that much of a problem, but people are very concerned about it.
I think it's important to recognize that addressing climate change is not anti-business. You know, we stand side by side with a lot of industry in this global fight. We fully support, there's a coalition of environmental groups and industry giants that are pushing for a federal program. And, you know, we think that's great. It shows a lot of leadership. The insurance industry is at the forefront of these efforts, in part because the companies are going to have to pay the future flood claims if sea levels rise and that kind of thing.
Interesting.
And business hates uncertainty. And the sooner we can get, you know, solid programs in place to address climate change, everybody, I think, realizes it's coming. We just need to design it, put it in place, provide that certainty, and move ahead with addressing the problem rather than continuing to fight about the minutia.
I do think that it's also really important to point out the economic impact of doing nothing. When your rivers dry up, you don't have tourism. When your rivers dry up, you don't have water to go into our tap to make new houses that people can live in. I mean, there's gigantic, just on a state level, not to mention the implications of terrorism and losing, you know, all the coastal cities in the world, of not doing anything about climate change.
I think that's right, and the costs of inaction are really substantially higher than the costs of acting. The problem, though, is that those costs are, the significant costs are further into the future, and so often we tend to just focus on the immediate problems right in front of us and ignore those longer-term problems. But there have been a number of studies around the world about the cost of inaction, and it's staggering.
There's another issue that is not directly related to the Western Climate Initiative, but it does speak to the question of delaying. There is an act that would affect the use of, what is it, emission standards, clean cars?
Yeah, that's correct. The Environmental Improvement Board, the board that passes most of our environmental regulations in the state, in 2007 adopted the California Clean Car Standards. At that time, there were just a handful of states that have done it. Now there are about 14 states that represent half the market in vehicles in the country that have adopted the standards.
What does it mean to have clean car standards?
Well, these standards do a few things. One, they address greenhouse gases. In fact, we expect to have vehicles in 2016 that will emit 30% fewer greenhouse gases. But not only that, it addresses other pollutants that come from tailpipes, like particulates and toxics and pollution that causes ozone. And it has this technology forcing piece of it called a zero emission vehicle that is also moving forward. Unfortunately, there is a couple proposals now in our state legislature to delay this. The program is supposed to start in 2011. But industry would like it to start in 2015. And so we're quite concerned about that. We think it'd be difficult to meet our greenhouse gas emission reduction target, and we also think it's not the right thing to do right now when we've got ozone levels in the state that are exceeding public health standards.
Is that right?
Yes.
So what if you had clean car standards, then people, I mean, where I came from Massachusetts before I lived here, and that I moved here a really long time ago, and even then you had to have an inspection sticker that said where they measured what was coming out of your tailpipe, and if you didn't pass, you didn't get a sticker.
Well, you won't have to do that with this program, with the Clean Car Standard. The responsibility for the program lies solely on the manufacturers. They have to deliver to the state cars that meet these specific standards.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't mean that the emission program that's in Bernalillo County right now will expand throughout the state. It really falls on the manufacturers.
So basically, if we just all keep on driving our 1972 pickup trucks, nothing will ever change.
Well, those are exempt. It's only for new vehicles that are coming into the state. And you know, the idea is that they will eventually die and get off the road, though it seems like in New Mexico they live forever.
It's because they don't rust.
Right.
So we've got a couple of minutes left. I just want to give Sarah and give each of you a moment to talk about anything that you would like our listeners to know about climate change, particularly what our listeners really can do, how they can be active in supporting climate change legislation in New Mexico and in getting involved in general.
Well, I would, thanks for the opportunity to speak to that. I would encourage everybody to contact your legislators and help educate them about the need for climate change legislation and encourage them to vote for our bill for House Bill
653,
and support Representative Roedefer. This is a really important piece of legislation, probably one of the most important ones that the governor has this year on environment. You know, I just thought I would reflect a little bit. I graduated from college in 2001, and I was in Bonn, Germany, for the negotiations on the Kyoto Protocol, the year that the U.S. had pulled out and the rest of the world moved forward.
Good heavens.
And it was really sad and astonishing. And there I was, you know, hoping that they would do it, but really upset that one of the world's biggest polluting nations was not part of it.
The biggest polluting nation.
The biggest polluting nation, responsible for a quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions that are up in the atmosphere right now. And so it's one of the things that's motivated me to come, you know, in New Mexico to work on this and to work on this at an international level, which is what we're doing through the Western Climate Initiative. This is a U.S. and Canada effort with Mexican states observing, and it's a very important model. It shows that we can work together and implement a program like this and serve as a model for the nation and for the world and hopefully get the U.S. back on track to participate internationally.
I would add that it is equally important that the fastest growing developing nations, such as China and India and Brazil, also be a target of U.S. policy, so that any reductions achieved in the United States by these programs aren't overwhelmed by increasing emissions in the major developing countries.
Very, very good point.
Yeah, and I'd like to also add that there are things that the individual can do, you know, use energy more efficiency. Really, putting airs in your tire does matter. I know Barack got a lot of grief for that, but it does matter. Energy-efficient homes also are really important. But it, like Sarah, I'd like to encourage everybody to get involved in the legislature this year. It's House Bill 653.
Just a simple call to your legislator saying, I support this and I want you to also.
That helps.
Makes a difference.
Or visit them. Our legislators are very accessible. You could come down to the roundhouse and meet them and talk to them. You can show up at committee hearings and state your position. And if anybody has any questions about this bill or how to track this bill, they can call me. My phone number is 827-0351. I'd be happy to answer anybody's questions.
And that's Sandra Ely of the Environment Department of New Mexico. Jim Norton, you've got the last word.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to assure all the listeners that your government here, under the leadership of Governor Richardson, is doing all we can in order to address this issue. And it's a really serious one. It's a very important one. And we need the help from all the listeners out there in order to solve the problem.
Jim Norton is the director of the Environmental Protection Division at the New Mexico Environment Department, and he's chair of the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. Sandra Ely is the Environment and Energy Policy Coordinator for the New Mexico Environment Department. Sarah Cottrell is the Energy and Environmental Policy Advisor for Governor Richardson. And David Tunderman is environmental lawyer with Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer in Salt Lake City. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc and Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.